Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll continue our ever-expanding exploration into cultures of consciousness. About a year ago, or a little bit less, I gave a talk at a gathering called the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness, which is basically a lot of scholars and researchers who are interested in weird stuff. So I fit right in. And I gave a talk about ayahuasca. I was on a morning, there was a whole morning session devoted to ayahuasca. And it was very fascinating because there were a few people who had done ethnographic research in South America, both in indigenous or mestizo situations and in urban situations, and just a lot of very interesting perspectives, cognitive, anthropological, et cetera, were approached. But what I talked about was the curious way that ayahuasca culture in the West, in the developed world, not so much in South America, compares and contrasts with the history of other ethno-pharmaceutical substances that have entered into what we could still somewhat inaccurately call the counterculture. So here I'm not talking about LSD, which is a laboratory compound and only has slight relationships with certain other drugs that have an ethnobotanical frame. But I'm talking about things like peyote and psilocybe mushrooms, compounds or substances that have been used by indigenous peoples for their religious healing or magical rites. So, for example, in the 50s, the hippies, the beats, everybody already knew about peyote. And so peyote was really the psychedelic you were most likely to come across. People would do trip, you know, they'd drive down to Texas where you could, you know, buy it easily at that time and bring it back. And so people were sort of familiar with that. But the fact that it had that it was used by Native Americans, particularly in the Native American Church, which was not a particularly traditional use because the Native American Church emerges in the middle of the 19th century, roughly, and is very much a product of the modern trauma and encounter with Christianity of the Native Americans went through in the 19th century. But nonetheless, there's a lot of traditional frameworks for approaching peyote as a healing substance as well as a visionary or mystical one. But for the most part, it wasn't until the late 60s that some hippies started to connect with the Native Americans. And even then, it never really became a major dimension of countercultural psychedelia. Similarly with psilocybe mushrooms, although a little different, is that the way that people found out about mushrooms was through a report of the fact that there were people, particularly one woman, Maria Sabina, still using mushrooms in a traditional setting. And so, you know, there were some hippies who went down to, and beatniks who went down to Oaxaca in the early 60s to try to, you know, have the experiences, and some of them did, and some of them connected with the tradition legitimately, and a lot of them were sort of exploiting and being exploited in that weird kind of tourist psychedelic economy. But once again, as people discovered that they could grow mushrooms themselves, and that in fact psychedelic mushrooms are all over the place, there wasn't so much of a kind of traditional framework for experiencing them, for taking them, rituals, ideas about what the purpose or meaning of these substances were didn't have a lot to do with the ethnographic kind of history or the original traditional context of the compound. But ayahuasca is extraordinarily different in this way. And in some, and that's why I say that I don't really believe that you can fairly think about it in terms of the counterculture anymore. And what I mean by that is that if you talk to people who are interested in ayahuasca, who have done ayahuasca in the developed world, not people who have necessarily gone down to South America, although even that is very interesting, the way that it's become a pilgrimage for so many people for healing and for vision. But even in the developed world, overwhelmingly the context that people where people discover ayahuasca is in a explicitly or semi-explicitly religious or traditionalist framework. Even if sometimes the shamans are visiting from the south, sometimes they are Euro-Americans who have done very serious training, sometimes less serious training, and some people who even consider themselves largely sort of secular or psychological in their orientations will still maintain the traditional framework of a circle, of sitting, of all night, of songs, of a structure is implied that has carried with the drug, if you want to call it a drug, which is sort of unfair, the substance, as it has spread into modern, you know, rootless civilization. This is really important. It's very important. And I think it suggests the way that to understand ayahuasca, you have to, in a way, let go of a lot of the frameworks that we're used to thinking about psychedelics in the West that have to do with the counterculture. Because it's being used, experienced, understood, and integrated into people's lives in a fundamentally different way. And it's along those lines that I became very interested in today's guest, Adam Ellenboss, who's just come out with a really charming and wonderful book called Fishers of Men, which relates to his own experience growing up and his own trials and tribulations and his own healing through ayahuasca. There's a lot of accounts of sort of ayahuasca transformations of healings that you can find collected in various books. But this is in some ways the first book-length accessible story that really expresses what I'm saying is kind of different about ayahuasca from other psychedelics. I'm sure we'll talk about that as well as a lot of other things. But before we bring on Adam, I want to introduce, of course, Expanding Minds' marvelous co-host, Maja Daou. Maja, how are you doing?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, I mean, you must have seen that. I mean, you're interested in psychedelic culture and seeing how these things have translated. And you live in Los Angeles, which is a hotbed of all manner of healing and mystical exploration. Do you sense a kind of difference that's emerging with ayahuasca when compared with the other sorts of interests in other psychedelics?
Well, I do, and it's really interesting what you said about, you know, the pilgrimage and counterculture with psychedelics, because I had a very kind of unique experience with psychedelic culture growing up where I did, because I grew up on an island in the Pacific Northwest where, you know, mushrooms literally grow everywhere. I mean, they grew on the grounds at my high school. So the presence of the plant that provided the psychedelic was so prevalent all over the entire area where I lived that it was a very different psychedelic culture than, say, even if you went into the city in Seattle where you'd have to purchase them in a bag. I mean, for me, it was literally like the kids would run out into the forest and then the psychedelics were ingested. And so for me, my experience of that kind of culture, it was like an indigenous one where we never had like a shamanic guide, but we all had these really crazy, like very shamanic experiences in the woods ingesting the plant. So, I mean, you can really see the difference in people's experiences with the different cultures. And then, like, as I grew up and then came to L.A., I mean, it's just a completely different experience how people ingest psychedelics in countercultures or at parties or whatever than what was my experience growing up. And then, you know, you can add to that this whole other, like, religious theme that goes along with people that provide ayahuasca in Los Angeles. And you can see the difference between the different cultures that ingest psychedelics. And I think absolutely with the ayahuasca, there's a markedly different experience that people are having when you compare it to, like, you know, like you said, like LSD or something like that.
Well, that's what's so good about having a book like Fishers of Men, because it really goes through deeply the kinds of things that people go through and the different ways they come to encounter this visionary plant. So with all no further ado, welcome Adam Ellenboss to the show. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly, Adam?
Yeah, that's right. It's Ellenboss.
Excellent. Well, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, man. It's good to be here. I remember like listening to some of your Burning Man talks and, you know, various lectures you gave, like, before I was even, like, some of my very first psychedelic experiences. So this is really cool.
That's wonderful. So tell me about, usually when people are on the show, I kind of ask what their personal story is that led them to do whatever it is that they're on the show to talk about. But of course, in your case, that's what you did, is you wrote about your experience, a memoir of your life, as well as your encounter with ayahuasca. So just maybe talk a little bit about what led you to write a book. Like, what is it about writing and how did that play a role in your own journey?
Right, sure. Well, I mean, it's funny because I was in graduate school and kind of through a period of religious confusion and dissociation from my family roots. My dad was a Christian Methodist pastor growing up, and so there was just some disconnect between me and my family and my religious evangelical upbringing. And I was in grad school and simultaneously had a lot of drug problems, some real addictive things going on, and I was addicted to opiates and a number of other things. And psychedelics just sort of came in like a back door. Like, I thought it was just going to be another way of getting high. In the meantime, I was getting, doing really well in grad school. No one would have known that, in a more private way, I was really troubled, and pretty confused. And psychedelics were sort of the first chapter of putting things, together or kind of coming to an initiation process or coming through a healing. I mean, I accidentally took mushrooms one night thinking I was going to get high, and someone just said, "Hey, you want to try it?" Sure, I'll try it. And I ended up locking myself into my bedroom and like just really being terrified. It was such an introspective and highly therapeutic. Like, it was like I thought I was going to get high, and suddenly I'd stepped into like the psychiatrist of the universe or something. And so I was looking at all of my toiletries and being like, "Oh man, I hate my dad." And I'm looking at my CD collection like, "Well, who am I trying to fool?" Just such an eye-opening experience. And I had this deep realization throughout the night that I was not only tapping into something that was incredibly profound and in a sense intelligent and there to guide me. It's true that ayahuasca is sentient, but I believe that mushrooms have a very interesting voice, and so many other psychedelics have interesting frequencies you can tap into. Well, this one anyway was basically, deeply telling me throughout the night that what I'm tapping into is a part of an ancient, tradition on our planet that has many different faces. And I started to just sort of realize the shamanic roots throughout the night as the experience was, continuing. And so from that moment forward, it literally was as if, one evening of 5 or 6 hours worth of some serious introspection locked in my room really put my head on straight. I was like, wow, I'm addicted to all these opiates and I'm really interested in spirituality still, but I it's something different. And, it just opened up a whole world. And, it wasn't too long after that I started having more psychedelic experiences and reading Terence McKenna. And, I just kind of slowly but surely the gate of, the doors of my perception, I guess you could say, were just sort of slowly but surely open.
That's wonderful. It's funny. I always, in a little way, your story reminds me of Daniel Pinchbeck's In Breaking Open the Head, where you were, in many ways a sort of, secular, troubled guy, and you kind of encounter psychedelics, and there's this big like transformation. And I've talked about that with Maja other times when you grow up in a situation, and though I was a more suburban one than Maja had, it was like they were always part of our world. So there wasn't really the opportunity to have like a profound conversion experience because that they were part of my world since I was, you know, 13 years old. So it was, it's sort of, I always like hearing these stories because I can imagine if one doesn't encounter them until later, you know, even in your case, in your, you know, probably your early 20s, but you're, you know, you're on your way to, you're into your adulthood and you have all your, so a lot of adult problems and situations, just how remarkable revelatory they could be for some people in your situation, and that comes through really well. But you know, I read one thing on online, an interesting review of the book, which is was getting very very positive accounts about it. But how, the person said that while, you know, in a lot of ways the book is a really wonderful portrait of healing through ayahuasca, in some ways it's almost primarily about your relationship with your father, which is really so interesting. And he himself is a very interesting guy. When you say that, you know, he's a Methodist minister, you think, you know, in your head you get a certain picture, but it's a lot more complicated than that. And since he's such an important part of the story, could you just talk a little bit about like what his history was, and in some ways how that set you off on your journey, even if it was very difficult for a while?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's been the hard part about describing the book, but also I think the journey of the book is understanding this relationship. That's definitely one of the key points I was conscious of creating while I wrote the book. And because there's, I think, a really common idea among, you know, countercultural people, or, you know, people who have had their mind expanded in some way and are on a spiritual path of some sort, that Christianity, especially sort of evangelical American, you know, Protestant Christianity, is just sort of, you know, just all just mean, you know, angry jerks and you know, just trying to convert you, and just, you know, this whole picture comes to mind. In many ways, it's true and totally, you know, I grew up in evangelical tradition, so that was a huge part of it. However, you know, there's, you know, huge amount of very liberal ministers in these traditions who were inspired to go into the ministry in many ways through psychedelic experiences in the late 60s and early 70s. And, you know, their mind was open, but since they had been brought up in, you know, incredibly fundamentalist houses, like my father had been brought up in a really, you know, a sort of free Methodist, like ultra conservative church in Michigan that his parents, you know, brought him up through. And when he had his psychedelic experiences in the 60s and 70s, his first thought was to go into the church, you know, as a pastor, but as a sort of, you know, like a covert agent, someone to try and expose the more universal tones of the gospel and stuff like that. So, I mean, my father grew up with Pontiac Native American friends and did LSD in college and was a person who liked to spend time in nature, and he loved Emerson and he played guitar and he liked Crosby, Stills, Nash. And so there was this whole side to my father, but in many ways his love for you know, all sort of transcendental spiritual things, you know, the only way he saw himself being able to, I think, play out his spiritual, you know, destiny or vocation, and was to enter into the ministry. So you had him playing the sort of evangelical role at many parts in my life. Like growing up, he'd be an evangelical minister, but he was always sort of slipping in, you know, more universally toned messages in his sermons, and, you know, just kind of, like I said, playing at the same time in this weird way. So that's kind of the, you know, and then it's confusing. I mean, when I got to high school, you know, and my father's popularity had grown and grown and grown, here's this, like, he's bringing so many people into the churches specifically because he's not telling people that they can't have an interest in Buddhism on the side, or if they, you know, if they think that the Buddhist message is similar to the Christian message, my dad would be like, hey, that's cool, whatever. You know, I mean, he'd stay pretty mainline, you know, evangelical in church, but in, you know, in as a person, he was just embracing of a lot of different people. And I always saw his liberalness as a distant and cool but inaccessible thing, something that, you know, I saw him offering to the people of the church, but working 70 hours a week, I didn't get to experience the same thing at home. So my concepts of my father were based around all of these confusing ideas and images of him as a public figure. So when I got to high school and, you know, my family was at a massive church in the suburbs, my dad became more like a CEO, and he had an affair. And at that point, I remember Bill Clinton was just, you know, getting in trouble for his affair with Monica Lewinsky, and he could come out on television. And I remember, like, you know, at that time, also my father having an affair, and I kind of found out about it a few years before the rest of my family did. I kind of caught him, and I never said anything. But I remember immediately just associating all of my father's liberalism with this betrayal of his, you know, his marital fidelity or whatever, and sort of like, well, if you can any gods and sort of just open-minded and anything goes, and that certainly explains your behavior with women. And so my big high school,
which of course the you know, anyone paying attention to the news and sort of the behavior of conservative pastors and such will but I mean, it makes sense. Like, it totally makes sense. I mean the whole way that the dynamic that your father has as a character in the book, because of course I don't know him, but what's fascinating about it to me is how he contains within him both this sort of liberal and even countercultural open-mindedness, and yet his institutionally, in terms of his role in society, it's very mainline. So it's not like you know, your story is very much a story of your generation and not of a previous one. It's not like, oh, I grew up in the 50s and everything was lame, and then I discovered, you know, the wonderful world of exotic religion and drugs and sex and all that. You're coming up in a very different situation. Your father is already embodying that contradiction, and in fact the transformation that he goes through in the book are as interesting as your own in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I mean, you know, at that time when I saw these contradictions in my father, I was you know, at least 5 or 10 years away from understanding the sort of generational contradiction that he was embodying. You know, it took me going to Peru, really, and drinking ayahuasca to come to a place of, you know, forgiveness within myself, you know, for just being a kid and not understanding things. And simultaneously, you know, for my father, too, who in many ways, I think, you know, it was just hard. He didn't, I don't blame him at all. But, you know, now I look at it, I have a great deal of understanding, but I was furious with him for a long time. I mean, my big rebellion in high school was to go and join a Pentecostal fundamentalist Baptist church that was just, like, truly, like, Republican, right, white, male, like, the whole thing. It just completely pissed my parents off.
Now, there's rebellion for you. How long did that last?
Well, I mean, I think I was about 17 or 18. I started going to the Baptist church and the Baptist youth program and you know, the Baptist camps, the kind of like, if you ever saw, there was a great documentary made on the sort of Pentecostal fundamentalist kid, like, church Bible. I think it was called Jesus Camp.
Yeah, Jesus Camp.
I went to some of these types of, you know, retreats and camps during the summer, and then I went to this college. And at my Baptist college, you know, while I was there, the book tells a story much better than I can summarize it in a few lines. But I guess the short of it is that, you know, you can't stray too far into that realm when you're, you know, if it's based on anger anyway, because I mean, I just realized after a few years that, you know, it wasn't for me, the whole fundamentalist trip. I just, no matter how hard I tried to like, you know, play that role, it just wasn't working for me. So,
well, it's interesting because a lot of people don't really, I mean, maybe they do more so now, but they don't really recognize that as a form of rebellion. Like, for me and all of our generation, I mean, a lot of our parents are hippies, and like, my mom was a hippie too, and I would see a lot of my friends whose parents were hippies, they would turn into these staunchy Republican types that would just be like super skeptical. And it was all, it's the same thing when you swing the pendulum too far one direction and the response goes the other way. And I think that's just that common rebellion that happens. And it just takes the form of opposing whatever it is that you're up against. So you oppose their ideologies in whatever way as a youngster that you feel is like going to be the most harmful to them.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so funny because actually I would say that the shift that was being made was, you know, I guess like swinging all the way to the, it started with, you know, I guess anger and just a feeling of this displacement, moving around all the time and just not really connecting with my family and kind of becoming a social outcast and just a loner. And then, you know, swinging the opposite direction, going to fundamentalist Christianity. And then within there, you know, the swing started the opposite direction by starting to smoke pot and, you know, drink alcohol and have sex a lot. And then it went to the completely opposite extreme, which was like a complete, you know, the in many ways, a sort of hipster, cynical, I have the best music collection I have, and it's, you've never heard of every band that I like, and that just definitely makes me better than you. And I have done every drug that you've never done, and I can handle way more liquor, and I can have more sex and keep a cool attitude and never piss try to never piss anyone off, but also be untouchable and cool and that whole thing. And, you know, and so that, you know, it was just like, back and forth, basically, like you just described, you know.
Yeah, it's just methods of identity dodging, really. And it's interesting what you're talking about, because I just watched this documentary called Hoffman's Potion, and it was about the fellows in Saskatchewan who did some of the early research with LSD, and they were giving it to alcoholics and, like, addicts, like opiate addicts, like you were. And they, at first, they had started the program because they wanted to, like, have the alcoholics and addicts have such a terrible experience on LSD that they would, like, never drink again. But what they found happened was when they gave the LSD to the alcoholics and the opiates, that they actually started becoming aware of their behavior and, like, wanting to be interested in making changes. And they actually had these wonderful experiences, kind of like what you talked about, how, you know, when you did the mushrooms, you became aware of, like, some of your behavior things, like the ridiculous music collections or that you were hurting your family. And they found that that was actually what these addicts had on a lot of these psychedelic experiences, first of all, recognize their addiction, and second of all, have like this instigation to try and make behavioral changes.
Yeah, it's incredible because it's I think it does, like, I've noticed two things with, you know, both the psychedelics. I mean, I've kind of committed to focusing on my sort of studies and examination of the ayahuasca tradition ever since I found it, but I still have a great deal of respect for the reverent, you know, sort of safe use of psychedelics otherwise. But I've noticed the trend in, you know, properly used sort of plant entheogens in general, which is that it's almost as if, you know, it's like meditation or yoga, I guess, or anything that helps you start to, it's almost as if there are certain archetypes, behavioral archetypes that are in your life, and they're multivalent. You know, the core meaning remains the same while the appearances shift. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, it's as if, you know, these plants have a way of sort of, you know, plucking this jewel of a behavioral archetype out and then sort of rotating images or understandings, whether it's visual or verbal or, you know, whatever, and they'll rotate these understandings of the different ways in which the archetype is appearing in your life. It's absolutely incredible to see it, you know, from the sort of objective point of view. And in many ways, I feel like the way that it's done is just, it's just minus the tone of voice that you might get coming from a therapist or a religious leader or, you know, something that could get, some gunk that could kind of get caught in the filter, and there's just no gunk there. It comes through in a way that you're just like, okay, I can accept that, you know, like, I don't know whether it's a little bit of humor that's used or whether it's just the sheer aesthetic, you know, like you're just like, wow, that is aesthetically pleasing the way that was just presented. It's just like beautiful. Even if it's really difficult stuff to deal with, it's being presented in a way that's like, you know, it's like the equivalent of like a wonderful, like, logic puzzle strung together through an interesting visual mandala that's just, you know, that kind of thing. So at the end of the day, I feel like that's kind of why it does it. Without a lot of it, to me, it's somewhat amplified, and I think peyote and even mushrooms can do this too, but it's somewhat amplified by the fact that at the crucible of some of these understandings, if there's like any blocks within you to understand, you know, to like, you're like, oh, I'm not quite getting this, or I'm not quite seeing this, or you have some resistance to what's being shown to you, you may just, you know, vomit for 10 minutes straight. And that is, then all of a sudden it's as if the vomiting or the purging can sort of unlock It's like it becomes a skeleton key for understanding. Oh, now I get it. You know what I mean? And that can be even, I mean, it's powerful enough to just have an understanding of what needs to change. But when it becomes programmed through this physiological event, it's like it seems to hold some kind of special power that stay. It has like staying power. It sticks with you.
That's wonderful stuff. I want to talk to you more about that, but we got to take a break right now. This is Eric Davis with Maja Daou. We're talking to Adam Ellenboss, the author of The New Fishers of Men, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hello, everybody. This is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. I'm on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com twice a week on Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to guide you and hold your hand through the worst economic catastrophe of all time. I predicted this right here on PRN back in 2005, along with the housing meltdown. Listen in and hear how this calamity is about to get much worse, and hear me suggest ways in which you can sidestep a large part of the horror. Call in and have your questions answered in real time. Let's see this thing through together. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com hosts my show Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. EST right here.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
This is Orly Cotell with Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking to our guest, Adam Ellenboss, the author of Fishers of Men, the Gospel of an Ayahuasca Vision Quest. And Adam, I was curious, I was reading that you do a little astrological studies. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I had read that you had, it was kind of instigated by an experience that you had. I study astrology too, and I had this kind of crazy mushroom star experience. And I don't hear a lot about people that kind of come across astrology that way. And so I was very interested in your experience just because, like, a lot of the research that I've done into it too, with a lot of the, you know, the heavier early alchemists and stuff like that, I mean, they would have those kind of experiences too, and that's kind of like where the harmony of the spheres stuff all came out of, and like a lot of these really important laws of physics, like even Isaac Newton had talked about some of his crazy mystical astrology experiences. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe like what the link up was for you between your vision quest and like leading into astrology study.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, You know, it's funny because it actually, it took me a while to come out of the closet as an astrologer, I guess, or as a student of astrology, because I think like a lot of people, like astrology, I think Richard Tarnas said it best. He's like, astrology has been sort of ghettoized, you know, it's been
totally.
Like, and I think in many ways because of that, you know, whenever something is treated like that, in many ways it starts to attract the very negative aspects that are cast onto it. So you do get people who study astrology who end up, you know, being sort of psychic manipulators or energy vampires or fortune tellers but to me, the study of astrology really began in a super healthy context. I only really knew my sun sign, I guess, and then I had an ayahuasca experience in Peru, and basically how it worked out was this. I started to, like I said, to understand these archetypes, and for one of mine was obviously, I guess you could say, a sort of imbalance of a Venetian archetype in astrology. As you know, I'm sure that, you know, Venus is really connected to our physical worldly values as well as other values in Libra, but I'm talking more about the Taurian kind mm-hmm. of value and value development. And you know, when you're a drug addict and you're eating too much food, it's all coming from unbalanced emotions and all this stuff. Well, I guess you could see I had a Venetian imbalance. Mm-hmm. And I started to see that in a vision, like literally, tons of glyphs and pictographs and just things that I have no way of really describing, but they were all Venetian themed. In fact, I saw the famous painting of Venus on the half shell or whatever.
Botticelli.
Yes, exactly. Saw Venus on the half shell but surrounded or sort of decaying or falling apart, kind of like the scene in Neverending Story where those beautiful sort of statues with the voluptuous sort of feminine statues are like falling apart and Atreus that was the kind of thing. It was like Venus, but looking like it was decaying and I saw planets and just glyphs, and it was so intuitively clear to me that I was seeing an astrological energy. I mean, as clear as just the visions in front of me, and then simultaneously like a voice in my head going, that's astrology, you know.
That's so awesome, because so many people, they remove astrology from themselves and can't have like an experience of the archetype like you literally describe. I mean, they think it's like, you know, oh, well, the planets are up in space and that's like dictating some kind of energy, but it's like an energy that you can feel that's manifesting in your life. So that's like pretty tremendous that you were able to have an experience like that.
Yeah, for sure. And it just deepened as I started to study the archetypes more formally, I guess, just, you know, reading books and looking at charts and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. The studies just deepened so quickly when I would, you know, I would bring that process with me, that learning process with me into 80 plus ceremonies over 5 years. It was all like, every ceremony I would get something like, you know, I would start going into a Piscean dimension, for example. And, you know, then as I started to kind of, you know, make my way through this particular Piscean passage and figure out its riddles and myths and stuff like that, my feet were like, you know, primarily involved the whole time. Like I would notice my feet tapping, and then when I did good, like my feet would feel like little dwarves dancing, and that was so I would be like, oh my God, Pisces rules the feet. You know what I mean? Like just little moments, tidbits here and there that made the teachings, in some ways, they started to kind of wire themselves into my body, and you know what I mean? Just a profound way to learn, I think. And I've also run into people, for example, I know a guy who's, he's working with ayahuasca, like a small tablespoon in the morning before he's a yoga instructor and used to have his own studio. And so he works with a little bit of plant medicine every morning to inform his study of the asana postures, which of course are all sort of archetypal as well. I think there's a great potential.
That's a very interesting discussion. But I want to switch to another archetypal myth system, which is to go back to, to Christianity, because, you know, with the title of your book and the subtitle, Gospel, Fishers of Men, and your, you know, your whole tale with it, you open up again a somewhat unusual perspective on Christianity and on Jesus from the perspective of someone who's gone through this process, because it was very easy to imagine a parallel world where the parallel Adam has the same upbringing as you did, and goes through your downward spiral and discovers the healing medicine, but leaves Christianity behind because it's associated with, you know, all the sort of reasons that so many people in the left or countercultural types distrust Christianity. But that's not what happened with you, and that makes and what's even more interesting is, of course, many of the traditions within which people are discovering ayahuasca from South America have a very powerful role for Christianity, albeit a very different Christianity than most of what we encounter here in the United States. But, you know, though you wouldn't know it by looking at the sort of, you know, hippie profile of a lot of people who are interested in ayahuasca, let's say in the West Coast, you know, Jesus is as central a figure of the ayahuasca universe as, you know, whatever, Pacha or the Jaguar or whatever. Jesus is extremely important in that world. So talk about a little bit what that's like for you to sort of keep that alive, and how that shifted for you, and why that was important for you to bring forward in the book too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I had my first, like, you know, I had my first encounter the other day with an evangelical, very, you know, sort of fundamentalist minister contacting me and trying to engage me in a debate that was essentially the premise of which is that I'm a heretic and this debate could possibly lead me back to Jesus. Right. So I was like, and I was excited though, because, I mean, in many ways it's true. Like, I wrote the book specifically to engage with a community that I have a lot of love for. You know, I mean, I grew up in the Christian church, and although I have a lot of, you know, I have some bones to pick or whatever, with certain doctrinal beliefs and uses of scripture and dogma and all this stuff, but at the same time, you know, I mean, these people in the churches raised me, and I saw them attend to people in hospitals, and I mean, there's goodness of heart in a lot of these people. And so one of my intentions in my book was to just engage the sort of Christian evangelical community in a honest discussion about some of the gospel and some of the scriptures and the person of Jesus, at least, you know, whether or not he existed historically in the way that the sort of New Testament stories tell us, to me is, you know, sort of, I guess, irrelevant. I don't know. And so I can only, you know, sort of talk about it in this one particular way. And I'm interested in a huge variety of, like, I'm interested in all sorts of Gnostic texts and other things, but primarily to engage people in the more straightforward canonical New Testament scriptures. I think there's even a huge amount of possible, you know, room for discussion there. And so my thing has been to look at some of the more interesting scriptural, you know, passages that are largely ignored or that just way too simplistic you know, the theologians are just way too simplistic about some of these passages. For example, one of the ones that I read while I was in the Amazon, I brought my Bible with me and was just checking it out while I was after ceremonies and stuff. And one of the ones that I came across was when the Pharisees were picking on Jesus for, you know, for kind of claiming himself to be at one with his Father. And his answer was to quote a passage, and this is in the book of Mark, I believe, back to the Psalms that, you know, said, you know, he basically said to the Pharisees, well, isn't it written in the Psalms that we are all gods? And I've scoured the internet, and I remember in college classrooms that particular verse, and it was one that haunted me for a long time, and I came to it again in the Amazon, and it's there's not a proper answer for places like this, and especially there's a lot more in the book of John, and of course the more Gnostic texts are filled with these incredible teachings from Jesus that are much more esoteric, and of course they're completely dismissed. But even within those, like that particular line, like there's just no good answer that I had found. And in the meantime, my ayahuasca experiences were presenting me with visions of Jesus that were so universal. I mean, my first vision of Jesus was you know, I saw Jesus walking on water and became prostrate in fear and my, you know, was saying thank you and couldn't stop saying thank you until my thank you sort of built themselves into a golden calf, which in the New Testament or the Old Testament imagery was associated with, like, you know, false idols that God was always, you know, sort of destroying. And there was this gratitude for Jesus that was becoming a false idol in front of me. And, you know, in the vision, that false idol was essentially just destroyed. And this immediate understanding came over me that the way I had understood the historical relevance of the person of Jesus or the scriptures or whatever had placed Jesus as an actual block between me and a personal realized connection to the universe or to the divine or something like that. And in my visionary experiences, I understood very, you know, intuitively over and over again in many visions that Jesus was, if anything, just an incredibly advanced and enlightened teacher that probably just wanted us to, you know, understand our own personal connection to the universe in a really profound way. But I kept seeing it over and over again, like, I've got my own cross to carry here, and, you know, this is my own, sort of my own journey that I'm on, and Jesus is like one of many outstanding examples. But, you know, that was the sort of first tier. And I'd say the second part of it was just this understanding that the whole paradigm of Christianity and evangelical churches that's based on the idea that you say a prayer and then you get salvation because you believe that Jesus performed some sort of function, and that function was, you know, atonement or whatever for your sins, and then you're delivered. To me, it was seriously missing the point that Jesus, you know, sort of repeats over and over and over again that all of life is eternal. And so I started seeing in my visions that, oh, I have a soul. I don't know exactly what that means, but I have this understanding of myself as something beyond linear beginnings and endings, birth and death. And that's not something that I can change or do anything about. It's not something I can say a prayer to guarantee the existence of. It's been there prior to my, you know, sort of illusory need for it. And so, you know, really quickly, the gospel message just it became like, well, what's the gospel message then? The gospel message to me became that life is eternal. There's nothing you can do to take that away, to lose it. And once you know that that's true, then, you know, most of the behavior that we have in our lives that's based on fear, causes suffering in us and in others, is really coming from, and I think, a sort of denial of our eternal nature. Like, life doesn't have to be. So, you know, once we know that that's true, we can start to do the work of making a more heavenly place. It's not like what's at stake isn't later. It's right now. You know, it's like we've got some situations here on earth that we need to clean up and stop thinking about eternal life. It's a sort of silly thing to spend your time on.
Well, I also think it's when you think about what are myths or our sacred narratives that one can try to grasp in the depths of the difficult side of the ayahuasca encounter that you described so well before the break, where you were talking about how your most difficult material comes up and you're in this situation and everything is completely bizarre and it's very heavy and your body is often extremely uncomfortable and perhaps there's a purge and that can be extraordinarily intense and cosmic and violent in some ways, or at least, you know, engage with a really powerful, unpleasant intensity that has a psychological and a dimension of fear, and perhaps your fear of death, and you're encountering your fear, and, you know, before you pass through, you know, in terms of like a sacred story, there's nothing like Christ on the cross. I mean, you're not experiencing physical pain, and obviously people are to the degree of that kind of intense violence on the body. But in terms of a psychic space, it's actually closer than most. And I think that aspect of Jesus or of the Christ is really the way into that, the more humane Jesus you're talking about. It's not just the eternal life, in my opinion, but it's also that there is in that moment a profound humanness and experience of suffering and even aloneness. I mean, he even feels cut off from his father and cut off from everyone. It's a moment of real stark trial where his whole person is sort of, his whole identity is kind of destroyed, and yet then there's this this resurrection, this new step, and there's something in that too that I think is really powerful. And I mean, the reason I ask this is I'm very into like the idea that especially in our society, in our culture, which is still Christian in some ways or in some very important ways, is that it's actually everyone's responsibility to like have their own Jesus. To meet Jesus on your, to have a Jesus that you like. And rather than turn away from Jesus as a sign of like those irritating Christians and they keep on going on about Jesus, just find the Jesus that is the one for you.
Yeah,
so like my Jesus is really cool. He's like kind of more, a little more Gnostic Zen or whatever, but he's a hard ass and he suffers like me. And that's great. And like, and so I was really happy to see him sort of like weave his way into this psychedelic story. It was really interesting for me.
Oh yeah, I mean that's perfect. I mean, in many ways, like the it's true, because you know, the many ways what I just described is almost like the resurrection rather than the crucifixion. You know, it's probably some of my Protestant training, because a lot of Protestants don't like to talk about the crucifixion, just the resurrection. But I mean, you know, and it's true though. I mean, and that's exactly what delivered it. It wasn't as if I was just sitting in these visions and all of a sudden Jesus came along. It's like life is eternal. You know, like
it doesn't really work then, does it?
No. I mean, the realization, I guess, that life will continue and persist came because I persisted and survived these incredible, you know, and it is like when you're in the sort of, you know, when you're in the teeth of these ayahuasca ceremonies, you think you're going to die or that you're going crazy. And, you know, but there's this profound sense of like, you know, I mean, I think I really first, I mean, I'd always heard, like, you know, Buddhists talk about the sort of, the inevitability of suffering and things like that. But I had no idea, really, what that meant until I was in these ceremonies and really feeling like, you know, like, I am alone in the universe, just a core of, like, alienation. And you go through the suffering. But what happens is that, you know, you find afterwards that something remains, and in the book, there's one point where I say I realized what was remaining. It was simple things like my breath, you know, my heartbeat, and you know, that was when I started to understand the eternal nature of life. And I didn't even say it in a more simple way, not just like sort of cosmic eternal souls and stuff like that, but just the simplicity of like, you know, a heartbeat and it's self-perpetuating, and I have no idea what makes it beat, and really neither does anyone else, you know?
Well, it's true, and I mean, even in science and medicine, the heartbeat is actually crazy. Like, there's this thing called the sinus node, which is literally like this little spark that sends an electrical shock to the cells in your heart that are, like, different than the other cells in your body, because they have this thing called like a striation which connects them all together so that they all go in unison. Like, it's actually the craziest thing ever that you could like envision in your brain, that like keeps the heartbeat going and connected and stuff like that. So it's interesting that you mentioned that in connection with everlasting life.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like the idea, like, I have a heart and it's still beating, and then just kind of like telescoping out, being like, the jungle is breathing, you know what I mean? Like, the earth is spinning, like, just kind of these realizations that come when you move through the purge, that they just expand. It's like you calcify in all these ways, with the concepts of your mind become like calcifications, and then ayahuasca sort of breaks all of them, and so you have this enormous sense of what's possible. And I think that's really connected to at least the feeling of like, oh, life is eternal, you know.
So what do you do now? You have an interesting gig. You work with schizophrenics. Is it like an outpatient place or?
Oh, I was working. I actually it's a crazy story. I actually I was working for a couple of years with schizophrenics as a sort of art therapist and case manager at a Franciscan residence home here in the city, which was, you know, talk about wild. That was really fun. And I feel like I learned so much. And that's a whole other subject too, because a lot of the people that had, when they had their breaks, had been unfortunately experimenting with a cocktail of both, you know, pretty serious synthetic psychedelics and like heroin and other things. And so that was like led me to a whole other exploration of psychedelics. But I feel like, after I, you know, I resigned from that job last spring, I started managing a yoga studio that quickly kind of fell apart. The studio went under, and right after that, around the time of the eclipse this past June, I had some ceremonies and decided to start Nightlife Astrology. So I now started this donation astrology project, and it's just been completely awesome. So that's what I'm up to now.
Well, that's great. Do you want to give any information about where people could go to find out more about what you're up to, other than your book?
Oh, yeah, sure. So you just go to fishersofmenbook.com to check out my book. I'm doing a reading in Boston in November for the local, like, Evolver Reality Sandwich crew. I blog a lot on Reality Sandwich. I'm a contributing editor there, you know, and live here in New York, and do donation-based astrology counseling and astrology readings, astrology workshops, and some classes and stuff like that. You can check that out at nightlightastrology.com. And yeah, that's me.
Well, we only got a couple of minutes left, and I know this is a big topic, but I feel that it's important. And you do talk about it a little bit in your book, is that what do you think for someone hearing this or reading your story and who's seeking and has wounds and wants to get more connected with the world? What do you see as one of the dangers that maybe people aren't thinking or talking enough about for people who are interested in the ayahuasca path, whether it's in terms of how it's affecting the, you know, indigenous cultures and the mestizo cultures themselves, or illusions that people often have a hard time breaking through? I mean, you've seen a lot of people, you've seen a lot of ceremonies, you've seen a lot of this enacted, and what would you give us, like, a kind of cautionary little last piece of advice for people who are interested in this path?
I would say that, you know, to for me, part of my path was realizing that a shaman and ayahuasca could not become substitutes for a fundamentalist, bent within me. So sometimes, ayahuasca has become another sort of false idol. And I think it becomes that way, depending on how willing you are to sort of turn over your spiritual guidance and your spiritual path to a shaman in particular. I think that's one of the major dangers that's out there. So just to trust shamans, there's a lot of good ones in South America. And, you know, I trust most of the places in Iquitos, for example. Most of the major lodges are run by a lot of people I know and pretty good souls, and I think you're pretty safe if you get some recommendations and stuff like that. But just to remember that, you know, your heart and your own gut discernment and your own mind are sacred, you know, spaces, and check in with yourself. If a shaman's saying something that, you know, maybe you don't particularly jive with, that doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to be ostracized from the ayahuasca world, or that you're not getting it or something like that. I think it's really important to maintain your own spiritual autonomy even through these experiences that will put you in many ways in a position of complete dependence upon the guidance of another. Unfortunately, shamans have egos too, and shamans develop followings, and it can become something that can, you know, you want to connect, I think, directly to the plant medicine and keep a great deal of reverence and everything like that for your guides, but also recognize that the truest guide is really within you, you know.
Great. Well, we'll have to end it there. Adam, thanks so much, and good luck with your book. This is Eric Davis with Maja Devu bidding you adieu here on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your minds open.